Haiti quake may have come as a shock to the millions of people who are now suffering through its aftermath, but it was not a complete surprise to geologists. Though large quakes in Haiti are rare, the country sits in the middle of an active seismic zone. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
If you live in California, you're used to occasional earthquakes reminding you that the big one could come at any time. The Caribbean is considerably quieter than that, but Carol Prentice at the U.S. Geological Survey says don't be fooled.
Well, it definitely is earthquake country. This is a plate boundary between the North American plate and the Caribbean plate.
The Earth's tectonic plates are forever in motion, and in this case, the Caribbean plate is gradually moving east in relation to the North American plate. The movement may seem slow, about an inch a year, but the edges of those plates are locked together, so they don't move all the time. Instead, stress builds up in fault zones, and one of those runs very close to Port-au-Prince.
You can see it on Google Earth. It's not that hard to see. It has a very clear signature through the landscape in the area.
So lots of stress, a big fault. To Prentice, the implications are obvious.
It's not a surprise to have a big earthquake along this fault.
What was a surprise, as is almost always the case with earthquakes, is the timing. Jeff Abers is at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory.
This is a fault segment that has been really quiet for about the last 200 years. There's one earthquake in the 1860s, but most of the larger known earthquakes were back in the 1700s.
So when the rock in the fault finally gave way and let off the strain that had been accumulating for more than a century, the resulting earthquake was very powerful. The ground shook for tens of seconds, and the fault gave way over a stretch that's currently estimated around 30 to 60 miles. Abers notes that the epicenter was not only very close to Port-au-Prince, the quake started at a fairly shallow depth, just 6 miles below the surface.
By being shallow and on land, the strongest shaking winds up being fairly close to population centers here.
The quake had a preliminary magnitude of 7.0, and since then there have been more than a dozen strong aftershocks above magnitude 5.
One of the concerns right now is there's a lot of structures that were badly damaged in the main shock, and they're now being exposed to these late aftershocks, some of which are quite significant.
The quake toppled many buildings that were not constructed to withstand such violent shaking. That includes buildings of brick and concrete that were not adequately reinforced with steel bars. Abers says there's also a lot of construction on Port-au-Prince's steep hillsides.
These unstable slopes tend to fail in strong shaking, and that's often where a lot of the damage could happen.
Early reports do suggest that buildings tumbled down slopes and that landslides contributed to the death and destruction. For the moment, all eyes are on the human tragedy in Haiti, the deaths, injuries, trapped people, and devastation in one of the poorest countries in the world. And Carol Prentice from the U.S. Geological Survey knows this will not be the last major quake to hit the region. She's been studying a fault that runs just to the north of Haiti and cuts through the Dominican Republic.
That fault, where we studied it, has not had a big earthquake for about 800 years, and it is certainly due for a large earthquake as well.
She says the local governments are aware of that hazard, but she doesn't know how well prepared they would be to deal with it. Richard Harris, NPR News.
In such a poor country, Haiti's buildings were simply not built to withstand a powerful earthquake. NPR's Christopher Joyce talked to Haiti's only earthquake engineer.
When he was studying engineering in Haiti, Pierre Fouché's professors told him that at least one building there would survive an earthquake, the National Palace. The palace now lies in ruins. Fouché is getting his doctorate in earthquake engineering at the University of Buffalo. He says, as far as he knows, he's Haiti's only earthquake engineer. Fouché says his family has survived, but he's saddened by the fact that so many who didn't were killed because buildings in Haiti are so poorly constructed.
Many of the people there are doing whatever that they want. They can build whatever that they want. One of the biggest problems, too, is that in the country, we do not even have a national building code, which is very sad.
Fouché says people with money can build reinforced concrete buildings with steel rods to strengthen walls and floors. But he says even these may not meet engineering standards to support a load vertically and definitely cannot handle the side-to-side lateral forces of an earthquake.
it's like earthquake, which is much more of a type of like lateral loading. For lateral loading, you need to have like special construction, but in many cases, they are not designed, not even for like current daily loading.
But many people in Haiti live and work in unreinforced buildings, brick, block, or concrete. He says some of these buildings use stacked bricks instead of solid vertical columns to support ceilings. Earthquakes put enormous stress on rigid buildings. André Filiatrol, who directs the Earthquake Engineering Center at the University of Buffalo, explains what happens to a masonry or concrete wall that's perpendicular to the motion of the quake.
The wall just kind of explodes. Imagine if I hit a wall with my fist, I'm going to create a hole there. And imagine, you know, the shaking in that direction causing a bigger hole, so the wall collapses and eventually the slab falls down.
The slab being the wall or ceiling. Filiatro says televised images of Port-au-Prince suggest this kind of collapse was widespread.
The video showed a complete dust over the entire city. And apparently that dust lasted quite a while, 10, 15 minutes or so. And this seems to indicate these type of building, concrete building, pancaking, creating a lot of dust.
Several big aftershocks followed the earthquake. Pierre Fouché says that makes surviving buildings very dangerous.
Once you have the aftershock, it's like you are shaking a building that is already damaged. So this is quite likely going to bring those buildings down.
There's another threat to buildings and people in Haiti as well, quake-induced landslides. Haiti has very few trees left. It's one of the most deforested nations in the hemisphere. Mark Ashton is a professor of ecology at the Yale School of Forestry who studied the Caribbean. He says that without woody plants, water doesn't soak deeply into the soil. That causes erosion and unstable slopes.
You can get rain-soaked soil, very fragile, without any kind of rooting system, and you get very sudden movements, landslides.
Ashton says Haiti is a country with lots of steep slopes that are vulnerable to landslides. Besides the threat to people below, they could cover roads and slow down rescue and relief efforts. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We talk about beauty in people, in nature, in art. How about beauty in condensed matter physics? NPR's Joe Palca reports now on a physicist who found some.
This is a story about matter and the beautiful properties it can display. But to understand what kind of properties and what sort of beauty, you have to dig deep. So let's get started. The stuff the world is made of comes in a variety of phases. There's the gas phase, the liquid phase, the solid phase. And each of these phases has different characteristics.
Liquid flows. Solids are stuck there.
That's Alan Tennant. He's a condensed matter physicist at the Helmholtz Center Berlin in Germany. Condensed matter physicists are concerned with transitions.
When you change from liquid to gas, you get a transition.
Transitions are interesting because matter takes on some unusual properties as it makes transitions. To get a transition from ice to liquid water, you add heat. But Tennant isn't working on something as everyday as the phase transitions of water. He's interested in the exotic transitions of the element cobalt, and that requires exotic tools.
Instead of using heat, we use high magnetic fields and very low temperatures.
Really, really low temperatures, like close to absolute zero, as low as you can go. This is where quantum physics kicks in. In the quantum world, it's all about how single atoms of matter behave. And in the quantum world, the states of matter are not at all like the ones we know, and their transitions aren't either.
At the exact point where you change from one state to the other, that's where you get the really important stuff.
Some transitions are complicated and messy, but not the ones Tennant finds in his cold cobalt.
The quantum aspect of the system provides a kind of simplification, a kind of extra layer of order in the system that you wouldn't expect.
In fact, the order Tennant and his colleagues found has a kind of beautiful, complicated symmetry.
They found this E8 symmetry.
That's Robert Connick, a physicist at the Brookhaven National Laboratory. Now, here's where the story gets kind of tricky. Explaining transitions in quantum states of matter is easy compared to trying to explain E8 symmetry, but it's part of where the beauty lies, so let's try. E8 is one of a group of symmetries known as Lie symmetries, first studied by a 19th century Norwegian mathematician named Lie. Connick took a crack at explaining them.
If you had a ball, something that was perfectly spherical, the ball can be rotated about any of its axes, and the ball looks the same.
So Lie symmetries are things that stay symmetrical when you rotate them, like spheres.
That would be the very simplest of the Lie algebras. There's more sort of generalized notions of rotations. For example, you can go to think about symmetries involving rotations in higher dimensional spaces.
I think I'd rather not just now. But the point here, as Alan Tennant says, is that in this weird quantum world, under certain precise conditions, a new kind of order emerges that was previously unknown.
When I started out, I really expected that quantum systems would be somehow more complicated and, you know, somehow more confusing than the everyday world that we're familiar with. But every system, basically, that I've looked at has turned out to be elegant. It's turned out to be truly beautiful.
So beauty lies at the heart of matter. But then English poet John Keats knew that when he wrote the last lines of Ode on a Grecian Urn. Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. So beauty lies at the heart of matter. But then English poet John Keats knew that when he wrote the last lines of Ode on a Grecian Urn. Beauty is truth, truth beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
There are some things that many of us do not do, even though they would save us money, like switch to compact fluorescent light bulbs, or buy a new energy-efficient refrigerator, or just turn off the lights in an empty room. It's as if we like wasting money. Now, that's not true, of course, but it is a hard problem to fix. NPR's David Kestenbaum from our Planet Money team has more.
Dan Riker thinks he knows the solution. Every family just needs to attach this little device to the fuse box in their house. His family did it a few months ago. The device is pretty simple. It just measures the amount of electricity used in the house. He can see the information on a meter in his kitchen or online.
And every time I go to Google something, or look at the weather or sports or the stocks, there sits my electricity use in real time.
Can you show me right now?
Yeah. Let's see. I'll look back.
I need to mention that Dan Riker works for Google, which wrote the piece of software he's using. It's his job to show this stuff off. We met at the climate change talks in Copenhagen, where it was often pointed out that conservation, energy efficiency improvements, those are the easiest ways to begin to combat global warming. Riker thinks there's a simple reason we don't do these things. We lack information. On a laptop, he pulls up the information, a very detailed graph. You can see exactly when his family wakes up, because the line goes up. The kids turn the lights on. His wife uses her hairdryer. Then there's this other huge spike.
My six-year-old son saw this the other day, and it finally dawned on him. He was looking at our little meter, which normally is at 200 watts, and this thing shoots up to 1,800 watts. He said, "Daddy, look!" And it was simply the toaster, you know, turning electrical energy into massive heat energy to singe this toast.
Every bump or mountain on the chart was a mystery. And he found some easy things he could do to save money.
I kept seeing this big spike, and I began to suspect it was my furnace. So I had my son go in the living room and turn the furnace off using the thermostat, and all of a sudden, within a couple of seconds, I saw this peak just drop precipitously.
It turned out his furnace had a really old, inefficient motor, the thing that blows the heat around the house. So he replaced it. He also got a new refrigerator, which eventually will save him some money. Dan Riker was an assistant secretary at the Energy Department under President Clinton. He and people like him argue if we just had more information, we'll save money and we'll be better people and we'll help the environment.
So at a very general level, we think knowledge is power. And indeed, in this case, knowledge is less power.
Who wrote that line? You wrote that line?
You could send me to the penitentiary.
It is true that right now, electricity is kind of a weird commodity. People just get their monthly bill. They don't know what it's costing what.
Imagine going into a grocery store and there were no prices on anything. You simply put it in your basket, and at the end of the month you got a bill, you know, pay $671.15. I don't think most people would stand for that.
But there is debate about what effect these so-called smart meters would have. George Lowenstein is a behavioral economist at Carnegie Mellon University.
In fact, some of the information that a smart meter would give you might actually worsen your behavior because, for example, electricity is really amazingly cheap. It's amazingly cheap to air condition your whole house for a few hours. And if the smart meter is giving you objective information about how much it's costing you, you might be surprised at how cheap it is rather than surprised at how expensive it is.
Lowenstein says there are a lot of tests going on right now to assess the effect of putting in different kinds of smart meters. Some will do the thinking for you.
Like they shut down your air conditioning at a peak time. And there is some research showing that people are surprisingly willing to go along with something like that.
And that may be the most productive approach, he says. Let the machines make our economic decisions for us. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
And now some good news about men. Scientists have confirmed that they are still evolving, or at least the male chromosome is. NPR's John Hamilton explains.
The male, or Y chromosome, is what makes men men. A few years ago, scientists began wondering whether it was in trouble. When they compared it to the X chromosome, which is carried by both men and women, the Y chromosome didn't seem to measure up. David Page, who directs the Whitehead Institute at MIT, says the contrast was pretty stark.
The X chromosome, standing tall, robust, with many hundreds of genes. The human Y chromosome, just a hollow shell of its former glory, carrying on the order of 70 or 80 genes.
For hundreds of millions of years, the Y had evolved by getting rid of genes. And that type of evolution can't go on forever. So Page decided there was something he needed to know about the Y chromosome.
Was it really simply a victim of an inevitable fated demise? Or had it developed some new tricks along the way?
To find out, he and a team of researchers compared the Y chromosome of a person to that of a chimp. Page says it turned out that both Ys have been evolving really fast for the past 6 million years or so.
It's as if the Y chromosome is a house that's constantly being reconstructed or remodeled.
A house without too many rooms, but there's a lot going on, more actually than in chromosomes with many more genes. Page says that's possible because the Y chromosome contains unusual stretches of DNA that work like tinker toys. They're easy to pull apart, flip around, and reassemble for a new purpose.
It shows quite a degree of inventiveness and creativity that maybe the rest of the genome could learn something from.
Like how to make the most of the genes you've got. The study appears in the online edition of the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.